You're listening to the Yeshiva of Newark podcast. I'm your host and curator, Rabbi Avram Kivalevich, and I hope you enjoy this episode. With downloads approaching the million mark and an archival library numbering in the thousands, the Yeshiva of Newark podcast has been striving to continuously upgrade our content, professionalize our audio sound, along with altering approaches in light of much appreciated listener feedback. I firmly believe the niche has been carved out that resonates with many on the wide spectrum of observant Jews. This explains why we continually rank high in independent online lists of top yeshiva podcasts. That proud edifice is in real danger of toppling and disappearing. We need the help of our listeners to continue to record and edit, to promote a product that has been a balm and instructor to so many. Just $36. As a minimum donation from 1,000 of you out there will keep us afloat as a Newark of straight, intelligent, humorous discussion, lectures, debate, and inquiry, while the destructive waters of ignorance and identity politics, cyberbullying, crash around us. Your generous contributions will seal and galvanize this ark till it comes to a satisfying rest in an era of Moya Ritzdeya, heralding Mashiach, B'mheira, B'yameinu, Amen. So, if some of you are a little bit surprised that we begin this episode of Meir Einik HaChom, who is it with Meir Schiller, with the Canadian Brass's version of Sweet Georgia Brown, it's because basketball is on our mind. And of course, that was sort of the theme song of probably one of the greatest basketball teams. And that is, of course, the Harlem Globetrotters. I think whenever we hear Sweet Georgia Brown, it smells like, spells like, and you can somehow see Metal Ark Lemon and Curly Neal doing incredible basketball shots and antics. Ramir Schiller, I know this is not your wheelhouse, but we decided today to talk about basketball. And part of the reason is it's still March as we're recording, and in the premier tournament, basketball tournament in the world, I guess, would be the NCAA tournament. And as we pointed out in a conversation that we had yesterday, this weekend, the champion of, I guess, the ultimate yeshiva high school basketball tournament will be crowned. And that is the Sarachek tournament, which is happening in YU. And we're going to talk about basketball. And
Jews and basketball.
Yes. Kadursal. So, Ramir, tell us a little bit about some of you. You did a little bit of a deep dive. I gave you some homework. Why don't you hold forth a little bit?
Well, first off, I must apologize to all former Talmidim and players who would find it incongruous to the point of antipathy that I am holding forth about anything to do with basketball. My connections with basketball are fairly weak. When I started out as a Rebbe, I did go to the YHSQ basketball games. And in later years, when OTI or MTA would advance in the playoffs, I would often go to basketball games. But I don't claim much expertise in the sport, and even in the history, or even in terms of the Jewish, great Jewish basketball players of the 1920s to 1950s. I'm not a Bucky. There is a vast literature on the subject. There is a deep and long-held link between Jews and basketball. So we felt it might be of interest to discuss it and why it was. The more I spent researching the subject, the more it seemed to me that there was one other sport, which was the sport of the urban Jew of the mid-20th century, and that is boxing. In other words, these are the two sports that the Jews found accessible. And by accessible, I mean, for all the other sports, you need green grass and fields or ice. But this is the one sport you can go outside to the playground and you can play it. And obviously, boxing you can also do. So when we say Jews excelled at basketball, they played it, they followed it, I think they also excelled at punch ball, stoop baseball, and stickball. But there were no professional leagues for those three sports. So basketball was it. That was the Jewish sport. And as you noted before, in the Yeshiva League, the Yeshiva Basketball League is founded, I believe, in either 1950 or 51, I forget for the moment. And it was not until 1979 that the Hockey League comes along. So the Yeshiva Basketball League is a long-standing varsity and JV. These were great events, the basketball championships and playoffs at one time. So I think it's an interesting discussion as to the link, what it meant to Jews, what it meant to basketball in a sense. At one point, the Jewish, not Jewish colleges, but colleges which Jews attended in New York City, CCNY and NYU, and later on LIU, a lot of these colleges had national prominence. The city college teams competed in the NCAA, and it was one time what was the NIT.
Right, that was the NIT was the premier, actually for years, the NIT yes. was the more prestigious tournament,
yes,
right?
Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
And there were, I think City College, with an overwhelming roster of Jewish players, one year won both. They won
right.
the NIT and the NCAA. So there's a long-standing Jewish history here. Actually, when I was a kid, my father took me to the NIT finals, which was still in the late 50s and early 60s, was still of some significance.
The Jewish population in New York was obviously urban, and as you say, they didn't have parks. And basketball is a game that's played inside that John Naismith developed as something to sort of bridge between football and baseball, something that can be played in those inclement winter months. And this was perfect. You know, today, of course, when you think about basketball, you know, you think about height. But the Jews, as it was indicated in an article that you sent me from Ari Sklar, the Jews had like their own method of playing. It wasn't sort of like, you know, the alley-oop, you know, stand under the basket. It was a much more methodical game that they played. It was a great defense game that they learned to play. And this way, again, in our DNA, although there are giant Jewish giants, Jews didn't have that height advantage, but they used other skills. And I saw in the article, they mentioned that in some of the contests between the Western teams, the Southern teams, and CCNY, it was almost like it wasn't Jew versus Gentile, but it was two different styles of play. And the Jews excelled, you know, again, using, I don't know if strategy is the right word, but definitely a way to make up the disadvantages that they had in terms of height and speed and strength to be great players.
Intricate passing, very creative, intricate passing, deception, trapping defenses. Yeah, but later on, you know, the likes of Bob Cousy adopted such methodology, but that was how they succeeded. That's how they did it.
So it wasn't just the Jews. This was what was open for them, because clearly they couldn't attend many of the great football arenas. You know, this was a place where Jews were centered. It was City College and NYU, which had a very liberal admission policy. So this was really, it was natural that they should thrive in this place.
Right. And it allowed them to, the second generation Jews, it allowed them to sort of acclimate, to feel themselves part of America. And again, they were baseball fans, but they were not baseball players to that degree. So if we would say Ebbets Field was a place for Brooklyn Jews to become part of the American experience, they weren't doing it as players, but as followers. But basketball, since they were able to play that any playground, any gym, anywhere, so they very much became, they saw basketball as part of who they were. And the early NBA, even to that extent, had many outstanding Jewish basketball players before the NBA became very much based upon height to an extent. Also, again, the Jews were no longer immigrants. So the need to advance, the need to see sports as the means to achieve success, left the Jews to a large extent and was picked up by the blacks who, right. You know, it was their ticket to success.
It was the same avenue of success. You had a very much an urban community that was not wealthy, and you could practice your skills on a concrete court somewhere. And the number of inner city basketball superstars is immense.
Dick Barnett, who played for the, you know, the great Knicks teams of the early 1970s. He once said that you came home from school at 2:30, 3 o'clock, and you went out to the concrete courts, and they turned the lights on at 6, 7 o'clock. You played for the next 7 hours. You came home for supper. So it was very easy to acquire the skills necessary to excel, much like a Canadian boy has frozen lakes to play on. So here, it was very easy to go outside and play for 6, 7 hours. You need that amount of time.
But as you point out, as the Jews became more wealthy, as they moved out to the suburbs, they were able to enter the world of the American economy in ways that they didn't need before. They didn't need the basketball scholarships to be able to get into those universities and schools.
Right.
And that's, I think, another reason why Jewish presence in basketball has receded. You know, you mentioned to me before when we were talking about doing this program how, you know, I mentioned to you that the March Madness and the tournament of 64 that goes down to the Final Four and the championship is one of the great college events of the American year. And you said, you know, you wondered whether, you know, it's still college football. Both college football and college basketball are in a way in a tailspin because of various court rulings that are sundering the difference between professionals and the college game. But I still believe, you know, the amount of interest that this tournament takes. I mean, it's been documented, Mayor, that the effectiveness of workers has gone down because so many workers seem to be at their computers doing what the boss is telling them, but actually they're checking the brackets, they're checking the scores, the various pools that are going on. It does create a great interest, and I think part of it isn't just because it's two cockroaches that are racing against each other somewhere, you know, on some strip of land. It's because of the interest of these teams. They shape the tournament in a way where, you know, the Cinderella team could conceivably somehow get hot.
Yeah, that's sports. That's sports. It is a romantic drama being played out before our eyes, either as spectators or as participants, in which the entire gamut of human emotions and surprises and tragedies and successes.
Especially when the David beats the Goliath.
Sure,
when David
could
beat the Goliath, it's like, what a great story. And again, we attach to it, you know, so much. And I think there is a chain to it, despite all the money and everything that's involved.
Sure. The 1980 Olympic team beating the Russians at Lake Placid had nothing to do with money. It was pure David and Goliath. That's what it was. And
I'm from Memphis. We've talked about, of course, you know, our connection through Memphis. And Memphis is also a city that, because of its very strong black population, urban population, has become a sort of a breeding ground for great basketball players.
Sure.
But in the 70s, it was not a major power at all. In fact, the school that's now known as Memphis University was then known as Memphis State. And, you know, Memphis State University, MSU. And the players, by the way, from Memphis State would come to our Hebrew Academy and teach us about playing basketball. And we were part of our team. We had uniforms. I still remember mine was 22. And we had a great time engaging with the Memphis basketball players. And in 1973, those players that we saw that were our friends that came to us, they actually ascended to play in the championship game against UCLA, which was, you know, an incredible story. Here was this team out of nowhere, and UCLA, I think it had an unbeaten season that year. And I remember watching the game, and they were tied at halftime. I know these names might not mean much to you, but I'm sure you've heard of Bill Walton.
Great leftist hero.
Yes, but he was a very powerful center for the Celtics.
Yes.
You know, they came out after the half, and of course they schmettered Memphis State. Poor Larry Finch and Ronnie Robinson and all those other fellows that we knew from the Hebrew Academy. They went down into inglorious defeat, but they gave him a run for a half of a of a game. And it wasn't just the Memphians that whose hearts were lifted. I think, as you say, could it happen? Is it possible? Could it be?
What does Al Michaels say at the end of the 1980 Olympic team? Do you believe in miracles? Yes, you know. So absolutely. I want to sort of maybe segue in here because we want to sort of maintain some level of Torah and divine perspective on this. There was in the 1950s in New York a bit of an uproar because at that point, the yeshivas, RJJ, Chaim Berlin, I believe Torah Vadas at some point, were all playing in the regular, let's call it modern Orthodox yeshiva basketball league. And in the mid-50s, some of the Rosh Yeshiva apparently got wind of what it meant to actually play in these leagues. There were cheerleaders, there were co-ed crowds. And at that point, there was, I think, more of a merchak between what you did. You had a Rebbe, you went to yeshiva, but your own private life was somewhat private. And at that point, it was sort of being transformed into more of a Rebbeim involvement. So they withdrew. The yeshivas withdrew from the Metropolitan Basketball League, Jewish Basketball, Yeshiva Basketball League, and they formed their own league called the Intermesifta League, which I believe played for some 5 years, in which had only the yeshivas playing, and it had its own rules, its own standards, and then finally that too faded. So I think it's interesting to talk about that. I know, for example, here in Muncie, there's a very prominent yeshiva of that ilk, which proclaimed throughout the decades that all that was necessary for boys in the Mesifta was to have a hoop, or maybe two hoops, in the parking lot where they would play basketball. But then as some of the competition began to build gyms, what they turned out and they did was they built their own gym. So the question then becomes, you know, what is the role of this? What role should it have? What role does it have? And again, if there are three worlds of Orthodoxy, modern Orthodox, Yeshivish, and Hasidic, obviously, the more you move to the right, let's say the term is the right, the less there is any sense of organized sports. Some of them would forbid ball playing altogether. Satna Square, those places forbid it completely. Vizhnitz allows it until you go to Yeshiva Katana. And others, you know, the more leftist, the radical leftists will actually allow balls to be brought and played during recess, but not in any sense of serious organized fashion. So my question to you is, or to all of us and to myself, is what does the Ribon Shalom say to all of this? What is his perspective on that? I saw recently that I believe it was Benny Leonard, the Jewish lightweight boxing champion. His father said to him when he went into boxing, he said, Schlugen, Goyim darf in Schlugen, I eat Schlug nicht. So, which means the Goyim mother should be fighting. The Jew shouldn't be fighting. So again, that's boxing, which is an extreme example. But even basketball, organized basketball, uniforms, I think one of the transformations in the Yeshiva League in metropolitan area has been over the years, more yarmulke wearing during the games. Used to be less of that. The yarmulke fell off. It stayed off. So Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, and we can discuss, what does the Ribbono Shel Olam make of the Saracek tournament?
Yeah, obviously a very big question, and it really depends. You know, every bocher is different. Every person is different. But, you know, you've been on record here about, you know, the discipline that is encouraged, developed in sports. I mentioned this article that was printed in The New Yorker last week by Adam Gopnik. He quotes a philosopher, The Nguyen, in his book Games Agency as Art, that we tend to overrate or sentimentalize pure play as an ideal while condescending to organized and commodified games as secondary or corrupted forms. This philosopher insists that really all games are structured forms of play that teach us, through abstract, stylized example, the ins and outs of agency. In most of life, we pursue disorderly means towards reasonable goals. We want to get into the right college, find the perfect life partner, raise our children well, and we make foolish mistakes before we do. Only in games do we pursue orderly means towards ridiculous goals. Touching home plate with your toe is by itself a meaningless purpose, but we learn to do it in ways that are beautifully shaped and orderly and teachable. Now, he's talking about baseball, but I think the same thing can be said about other sports. Watching baseball, we learn cause and effect, strategy and tactics, the use of delayed gratification, how potent the anticipation of other minds can be.
We again stumble into a discussion we've had in the past, which is the instrumentalist view of sports as opposed to the essentialist view. So this man, who obviously likes sports and knows sports, but he feels constrained to go back to the Musa understanding of sports, which is it teaches us something else somewhere else where it really means something. Whereas, you know, I would always insist that sports is similar to music, similar to architecture, to art, is not there to teach us. It is a gift in and of itself of a loving God.
My bringing down this quote is a shtickle me lishitosa in a discussion that we had a couple of weeks ago about football.
But my limits, of course, on you and on this author is that you really do know that it's a wonderful thing, not just because it teaches you discipline in Midas Tovus. You realize that it is a wondrous gift.
Well, but again, we need them because we need to have this type of part in our life. We need to have this structure towards something ridiculous. We need it.
Why is it ridiculous? Is music ridiculous? Is art ridiculous? Why is it ridiculous? Clearly, God imbued it in the heart of man.
I think in this way, basketball and baseball can be somehow differentiated. One of the reasons I think that basketball is so easy to pick up because the goal is simple, right? You know, here's the ball. You need to try to get it into the hoop. And I'm going to restrict how you get it there. It has to be constantly moving in order for you to do that. You can't just run with it and then jump and throw it into the basket like three-year-old kids play basketball. But it doesn't have the sometimes maze-like proscriptions that baseball have.
Or football.
Basketball has a simplicity and a certain beauty to it. But when we have games that are a little more structured and that was out of bounds. Oh, where was it, on the foul line or not on the foul line? The infield fly rule is in effect. Or he missed the base. His toe didn't touch it. Those are things that get into, I think, they actually push the realm of the ridiculous, don't you think?
Is the realm of ridiculous pushed to music or art?
Well, there I think one can sit back and savor the aria. One can hear the tones.
Because it's following certain rules. Because it's following certain rules.
No, I think there's an inherent enjoyment that even the Bushmen from Africa could hear those tones and recognize them as something soothing, recognize as something elevating. But would as somebody who was not trained, he might appreciate the speed that Mantle had on the bases or the quickness that Maury Wills had in terms of fielding a ground ball or Brooks.
Are we dating ourselves here or what?
Yeah, or Brooks Robinson being able to somehow extend himself incredibly for a line drive. I admit those shots are outstanding and incredible. But the rules of the game, the rules of how we win and what has to be done, those are rules that we impose in order to have something that is a ridiculous quote-unquote structure.
No. In music, there are certain rules. You and I are not the aficionados who understand exactly what Beethoven and Mozart are doing to produce that.
But we know what happens, Mayor, when our grandson goes over to the piano and just starts hammering at it and thinks he's playing a song.
Sure. And or just throws the ball in the basket. The same thing. The more complexity we know of, the more the nuanced, subtle mind can appreciate. Everybody can appreciate on a partial level. And the more subtleties, the greater. I just want to insist on the notion that the sense of marvel that we have at all these things is not because they teach something. Music is not teaching anything. Music is music. music. It is a category, was the Ribbono Shalom created farzich. It's not in order to teach us not to chepa our friend tomorrow morning. It's not teaching us that. God made beautiful flowers. He didn't make beautiful flowers in order to teach us midas tovus. He made beautiful flowers that we should say, Hashemayim asapim kvod keil. Now, again, the person who knows there is a God will say to God, thank you, God. Thank you, God, for the NIT or whatever it is. And he'll receive it with gratitude, and that gratitude may make his avodas Hashem, hopefully, more full of hakaras hatov. But the Zach Alliance is the Zach.
Mayor, you know, I think you should be at least admiring of this very simple equation: play becoming game, because
which gives you more, which gives you a sense of discipline and menschlichkeit. You're saying
no, which also means that imaginative faculty that we want to encourage in children. That imaginative faculty, the simcha of competition, the simcha of things happening outside
creativity.
Right. So but play becoming game is a structure that allows better play because it isn't just repetitive. It isn't frustrating. I'm not just saying, okay, now you'll be a better mensch and you're going to know the dinim of Shemayna Esrei better. Play that's vild for the vild's sake, it doesn't go anywhere. It can't be shared. It can't be spoken about. And that's what game does. And therefore, if you're just going to tell the kids in the Chassidish HaChayder or wherever they are, go out and run around recess, come on, yetz, here's the bell, then you have not satisfied that play instinct. That play instinct is basically unfettered and will erupt in a negative way.
But I always say in the Hasidic Shevelt and the more staunch Yeshiva Shevelt, when I'll see very often how they act out physically against each other, pushing, shoving, yelling, screaming, misbehaving, all the things that haunt their worlds, I always say, boy, do they need sports. It would make the whole rest of their life more serious. I'll give you an example in the area of Zman, okay? Very often Zmanim in the more Hamish of Welt become this sort of Eitzah Tova as opposed to a rigorous thing. So the day starts, the recess ends. It's all sort of mushy and blurry. But if you know what a two-minute drill is, then you realize that time is a reality. Time can mean something. That's just one area. It's every area of life. The mushiness of a lot of their thinking could be improved by many things.
All right, you have sort of into my you're sort of into my area.
I am.
Now.
I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying yes. You're correct as well. It has a functionalist instrumental value. That is correct. Yes.
One of the things that you sent me that I appreciated reading before I went to sleep last night was the pride that the school that you were associated with, although you know MTA's parent school, Yeshiva University, has in its incredible basketball prowess. They are in, let's just tell our listeners, they are not, you're not going to see them in the NCAA tournament, but they are Division III. It's called D3. Yes.
Let's explain to our listeners here what D3 means. In college sports, a college has to decide how seriously they want to treat their sports. So the NCAA has rules. If you want to take it super seriously, you compete against other colleges, which also take it super seriously. But if you don't want to give athletic scholarships, you don't want to have the same practice hours and beginning dates. So then we are going to let you play amongst your own lesser committed schools. You're more committed to academics or to other things, to religion. So you play D3. Whereas if you throw all constraints to the wind, then you get to play D1.
But YU, it was very proud of their accomplishments, of their players. And it's quite something, you know, when you see the records that are kept, the fact of the amount of rebounds, the points.
Well, YU has to keep those records. In other words, the NCAA demands they keep those records. It's the reason why the Yeshiva Basketball League or Hockey League keeps almost nothing, is because when you leave the Orthodox Jews to their own devices, they're not so record-keeping. But when they have to play with the Goyim, who take this much more seriously, then they start to keep more serious records. So the YU records, which are the light, I grant you they are a delight. I mean, Yuri Teichmann's foul shooting at 92.5% of his foul shots back in the late 80s. It's nice to have that there at your fingertips to be able to see it. But again, I think that's more the Goyish influences than it is their own interest. But I've watched the Warrior basketball team that for years they were mediocre, at best mediocre. One or two times they had some talent there, but years they were mediocre. And they got themselves a new coach. I don't mean to, by implication, criticize the old coach, who was a very good man, but they got themselves a new coach, and they adopted a different attitude towards recruiting basketball players. So that's when the whole thing really, really took off. And in the old days, very few students went to the games. When they were coming in, you know, 5 and 18, they weren't getting that many students or others at the games. When they started winning, they got more people. So they filled up the gym during the great run of recent years. So again, my question to you becomes, is that good or bad?
Right. So what that does, I think, is as all these provosts and presidents of universities say, when they are, you know, they are asked by the board of trustees, why are we so involved in sports? It's right. Great for the morale. It makes people appreciate that they're part of this school. And, you know, there is something, not everybody can be in the Besmedrish in YU. This is, people enjoy going to the games. They feel connected to the whole community as a whole.
And that creates a greater link. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying part that they are happy that they're in this yeshiva. And you can see it. You can see it when a team has won. I can tell you when I was attending a chasen of a Talmud of mine in South Bend, Indiana. And it happened on the day that the Bulls were playing the clinching game that allowed them, I think, to win the championship. And, you know, we were happy. We were in the yeshiva. It was 90. It's 90 minutes away from Chicago. But as we were going back on the Indiana toll road, you know, we had the radio turned on for the basketball broadcast. When the Bulls won, almost every car on this superhighway started honking their horn. It was like a symphony of horn honking on the expressway. And you can imagine that if that was, you know, Chicago, which is a huge city. You can imagine that is replicated in many ways when a team wins.
So the Olam HaYeshivas would say, what gefel ha-goyish ha-narishkeit, the Yiddish Bachrim are involved in here. A few years back, we brought to MTA the author of a set of Musa Svarim, Belavavi Mishkan Evan, was that the name of it? And he came to speak to the MTA Rebbeim. And as he entered the library in the high school, he saw on the wall a picture there of the basketball team, in which they do that sort of embrace before they go out on the court. He asked us, what does this picture mean? What do we think of this picture? And after a few Rebbeim began to mumble and fumble and their answers, he said, if any Rebbeim can think that this is anything other than negative, I have nothing to talk to you about. And this big Balmusa got up and walked out of the Rebbeim meeting. Sayonara, that's it. If you guys can't say that this enthusiasm about basketball is bad, I have nothing to say to you. And I think that would be the standard answer in much of the staunch yeshiva shevelt, certainly the Hasidic shevelt. And they might tolerate it in the way we tolerate a little child playing with his toys. Okay, child, play with your toys. But certainly at some point you have to grow up. So I think there is a fundamental difference here in terms of how the staunch yeshivish and Hasidic shevelt, and probably even the YU based medrash hashkafa. In other words, I'm not sure if YU based medrashism is that much different. This is an indulgence we give those incapable of playing real ball, real learning,
real Torah mentality. You know, you mentioned about the goyish shevelt. I, of course, had a history of teaching, unlike yourself, in places where the teams that would be in the Yeshiva League, and some of them are here at Saracek as we are recording, they have to play a parochial high school league where they're right. Playing essentially other church schools. And it is interesting, you know, I've witnessed these games. I was part of the games. I went with my students. And as I was the mashkiach for the school, and I was you know, asked to deal with, you know, difficult halachic questions, one of the things that came up, of course, was that some of the places where our team played, and this was the Barron Academy in Houston, was venues that were used as a place of worship. There was a mother who called me with an emergency call that the kids are out there on the at the gym, and there's an altar right next to that, the place, because the gym is actually used as their place of worship. And I had to really start, I had to give a psak on the moment, because there was some of the mothers were saying maybe we should forfeit this game. You know, the kids had already gone out there. There were issues of Chilul Hashem that I was thinking about, you know, once we had showed up to actually like give them a slap in the face. It was one thing if we would just say, I'm sorry, we can't play this game, and we forfeit to start out. But to actually go to the place, to the field of play, and then reject them, I thought would be Eva on a very, very large level. But one of the things, I'm not just telling you this to give you a little bit of a halachic history, but to also tell you a social history, that these schools in places like Houston, Dallas, Memphis, and other places where they aren't surrounded by the large Jewish schools and Jewish communities like you have here in the Northeast, part of what these leagues teach them is interaction with the non-Jewish world.
With halacha
in terms of how we retain our Yiddishkeit even among these non-Jewish world. And of course, Barron, that I had the schus to be part of, my kids eventually won their division in the Houston area and then went to Dallas to play for that level's state championship. And there had to be a special hearing because the championship game was meant to be played on Shabbos afternoon. And, you know, the school sent their lawyers to be able to argue the case in front of the commission about the freedom of religion, you know, whether they would have to forfeit or not. And it was a national story, which I felt brought a lot of COVID to the school and to the fact that there are schools out there that are willing to make Shmira Shabbos an issue.
What I would put to you is this. If you would be placed in an ahistorical setting, which is probably impossible, all human beings live in history and time and place, but would we be placed in an ahistorical setting, the utopian desert island of orthodoxy, would you want to have competitive sports there? I think that's the question. Now, again, we all live in time and place. We all live in history. You were in Memphis, Chicago, and then I was here in New York City areas. But so that's time and place. You can't shed time and place. Beishraga has to put up a basketball hoop, even Beishraga, right? But would you want that if you were starting devoid of cultural and social influences? Or to rephrase it in a second more, would the Hamish Havel benefit? Would there be, you know, Square versus Vision, that's big basketball games, or the Aroinim against the Zaloinim? Can you imagine that game?
Look, here's what would say. Even from an ahistorical perspective,
okay,
I will tell you, let's go back into the historical period that we all stem from, the Dor Day of the Midbar. The Dor Day of the Midbar. And the Rechaim met the very young Avram Bornstein, later known as the Avnei Nezer. There was a question that he, this little boy, should perhaps become a mechutan with the youngest daughter of the Divrei Chaim. The Agudas Ezev, Reb Zev Nochum, brought his son there because his son was already renowned to be an Ilui. Now, it was during the winter time, and the little Avram Bornstein, you'll like this as a hockey person, was actually skating on the frozen pond. He was enjoying himself skating on this frozen pond. And, you know, they had spoken about the possibility of the shidduch. The Divrei Chaim then ascended into this carriage, and he passed this little boy that they had been talking about, who was like slipping and sliding and enjoying himself on this frozen little pond. And he stopped the carriage, and he told the boy to come in. And, you know, they spoke. And the question that was asked to this little boy was, in the Dor HaMidbar, that everybody received mon, how was a chai to Mekayim mitzvah tzedakah? What was Pesach Tiftach? Today, Yekav Dai Mechzor Sher Yechzelay. If the Rabbeinu Shalom is taking care of everyone, so where is it shy to give tzedakah? The little boy said, it's Pashit. He said, Dervasat Kehibin, Dervasat Kehat Merdas. That even though they were the Dor Deya, and even though that was the Dor that heard Teira, there were still differences. There was people who had more Das to understand and explain, and they would do that type of tzedakah with those who had less understanding. So even in this, take all history away, there's going to be differences between people who are attracted, who love, who marvel, who play in the fields of their mind, who can do crossword puzzles in their head, who can figure out the most complex ideas and love and even be misbeinen for an hour to come up with a teretz. And there's going to be others who don't have that daya. And for those who don't have that daya, who are going to be frustrated by the learning, and they are going to need an outlet that is going to make them feel positive about themselves. It's going to allow them a simchas hachayim in ways that others can't. So I would say, yes, even in a perfect society, you need to have outlets. And I think this is something that, and I'm 100% in agreement with you, but you know, it's not changing. Because the cheerleaders are gone, and the tzitzis are on their begodim. The yarmulkes aren't falling off. It's still right. Not changing. Why not? What's the resistance to having sports teams?
It's resistance to the army. I wrote a letter today to somebody about one of the Slifkin's columns about the IDF. And you think I digress radically, but I don't think I do. He's always probing the Haredish argument that our Torah is protecting the army. And he tries to slug it up in various ways. But I said, he doesn't get the point. That's not why they don't go to the army. They don't go to the army because they have a world and they want that world to go on as it is, even though that itself is a bit of a falsification because no world goes on as it is ever. But that's their greatest religious commandment, is their world should go on exactly as it is. And if they would go to the army, or if they would have a Sarachek tournament between Vizhnitz and Square, or between the two bubbles, you know, then they would not be who they are. And to them, the first mitzvah in the Torah is to be who you are. And so therefore, you couldn't have those fantastic games of the Zaloinim versus the rest of the Aroinim, and you know, you could easily put 20,000 in Madison Square Garden for the Aroinim versus the Zaloinim. Yeah. But it would sort of be like European soccer. You need the police to keep the fans apart. But you know, you couldn't do it because it would change who they are. It was common in Chassidus Chadarim once upon a time, if a kid brought in a ball or played with a ball beyond a certain age, the Rebbe would take a knife and cut the ball open and cut it open and then leave him the two halves of the ball. So this was not uncommon in those days. But of course, they must have that, because if not, who are they?
Yeah. Well, again, what you say, it's really a indicator of how unsettled and the lack of confidence they have in the strength of their life.
But let me say something that it does for the kid who plugs in, for that 13-year-old who plays with his Rekla, and then when he goes to Yeshiva Katani, he stops playing altogether. That kid is going to be more receptive to a lot of the things which the community wants. Their system produces something which the MTA system does not. So we have to know, here's what we have to understand. What are the ingredients of the recipe which produces their malus? And would we include an Aroinim versus Aloinim end of the year big game? Would that destroy the whole thing? And I think it might.
The fact that there's a hoop and a basketball, why does that make it goyish? We know that there are kids that can gravitate it and can enjoy it. What makes it goyish? There's no way that this is something that they can accept. They can accept, you know, all the types of ice cream and chocolate and all these other things that the goyish Welt has given them. But somehow this somehow can never be Yiddish because James Naismith developed it?
I hear the kasha to a devastating level. I do. And I ask it every single day. when some kid in Minkoch pulls the chair out from under the kid in front of him. I hear it every single day, and I see it every single day. But once again, I hasten to add, there is a product being produced in the hardcore Hasidic, and maybe Yeshiva Shevelt, which is not a bad product. That's my only aim. No matter how much they try to strip their minions of their humanity, their humanness wins. So, yeah, you're right. 100%. The inconsistencies of hardcore yeshivishism are blatant. And thank God for that, because it allows their boys to be human to some degree.
And I'll tell you that I recently met one of the star players of the Staten Island camp team. And he's a chosh of a mensch. And I met him at a wedding. And of course, I don't know if he could still go out there and run the fast break the way he did. But when I brought up those games to him, you should have seen the way his eyes lit up.
They remain human, despite all the attempts to render them inhuman. They remain human, of course.
And those moments of victory of the games that were played, despite all the dafi ashas and siyumim and simchas of Einiklach, they still remember with such fondness and great memory the games that they were involved in.
He's a human being. God made humans human. What I'm just saying is that B'nai Brakism denies that humanity. What would Rav Shach say to those memories? If he would say it, I'm not sure whether he would ask, get this out for Kinderzonspielen, yeah? Kinderzonspielen. So again, but I agree with you. Despite all their efforts, human beings remain human.
So let me just end with my own little zikaron. I was part of a yeshiva that wasn't part of any high school basketball league. We were a yeshiva that wanted to compete with Philly, Ner Yisrael Rabbinical College, the Mechina of Ner Yisrael. And yet we played one game we played, in an organized game. We played against the other yeshiva in town. Now Baltimore is embarrassment of wealth of yeshivas in Baltimore. But in those days, there was only two. And one was called Chofetz Chaim, but everyone knew it as T.A. And T.A., the fellows there, had long hair, big chups. It wasn't the T.A. of today. And they not only had uniforms, and they had a coach, and they practiced. And I think T.A. did play in some of the parochial games. But they came to play Ner Yisrael. Now, normally, Ner Yisrael did not have a gym. They had an outdoor basketball area that was a concrete that had crevices in it that was almost impossible to play on when the Baltimore heat became too hot. But this was a game that was arranged that we would play against TA. And the coach, Moshe Greenwald, picked seven players from our 80 kids that were part of our ninth grade. And I was Zoyche, Baruch Hashem, to not be one of the starters, but I was, I wasn't necessarily Havlicek, who of course was the sixth man, but I was either the sixth or the seventh man. Maybe I was the sixth man. The game was a tight affair. Because we were playing on our territory, the whole Besmedrash showed up. We were 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, and the fellows from the highest shiurim in the Besmedrash came to cheer us on. The TA guys were indeed formidable, but we were not only giving them a game, but we were up by 1 point with only a few seconds left. And TA, of course, in basketball, if they would hit a field goal, they would win the game. I remember I was sitting on the on the bench, looking up with puppy dog eyes to the coach. And even though the five best players were in, he could tell that I was hoping to at least be part of this experience, of this incredible experience that of playing against this team and maybe even winning. So I saw him look away for a second and then look back at me, and he said, "Okay, Kivel, go in." And he sent me in. And it's true, they gave the ball to their shooting guard, who, by the way, now is a Rosh Hashiva in Slobodka right now, and has written a number of svarim, but at that time he was playing for TA as the shooting guard. And he put up a shot, and it rolled around the rim a number of times, but it didn't go in. And I attacked that rim with so much energy. And there was a person that was at least 6 inches taller than me, hovering above me, but I was able to grab that rebound. And they swarmed me. The whole team was swarming around me to try to get the ball out of my hand, to somehow, with the seconds left, to somehow put up a field goal to win. And of course, it didn't happen. And that moment was really, in a way, so special for me. So special. It was, I take you back, Rav Meir, 51 years to that moment. Was it kinderish? Was it narish? What I remember from that moment is the graciousness of my coach, the fact that he was willing to send in, you know, a second-tier fellow because, yeah, would it sacrifice the game? And to give a person a chance, I think those are types of qualities that aren't goyish. Those are the type of qualities where we actually find, I believe, not just achdus, but a sense of belief in another person and the type of memories that could actually build your confidence and give you a good story to say on a podcast too, right?
and the shared joy.
Yes. And that whole Shabbos, despite the fact that we were the youngest group, the yeshiva came over to our tables to say, great game, Yishkayach, we're so happy that you won.
Despite all puritanical Cotton Mather-esque attempts to strip us of our humanity on the part of our leadership, we remain human.
Well, that's a great way to put it. Take care, my friends. Cherish those memories, my friends. Enjoy your participation and your fandom. We'll catch you next time. Be well.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please take a moment to share this or any of the many episodes available on our platform with friends in order to help grow our community. Until next time, Shalom.